Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
And now, part two in our quest into the minds of our nearest relatives, the monkeys, apes, and great apes. Are animals capable of complex thoughts? Can they plan and reason? It depends on who you talk to. We continue following the scientific approach to understand the nature of the wild creatures when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wildside News.
Continue our discussion with Dr. Rumbaugh, who is the author of Intelligence of Apes and Other Rational Beings, along with David Washburn, Dr. David Washburn. Both gentlemen work with the Great Ape Trust in Iowa. And we've been talking about Dr. Rumbaugh's research on the great apes, starting professionally for him in San Diego, and he worked with a whole variety of different species to try to suggest that these different species have different capacities to really learn and then transfer this knowledge, which would be a definitive indicator that they're actually able to hold thoughts or whatever the term may be, whatever the concept is, and then apply this, which would indicate some level of intelligence. One of the areas that you were just about ready to get into before the break was some of the experiments, fascinating experiments, that you began to bring a young, I forget if this was a chimpanzee or a bonobo, and have them grow up in association with a young child. Am I heading in the right direction here?
Well, we didn't have them grow up with a child, but they were reared as though they were a human child.
Okay. Let's have you talk about that, because that's such a fascinating part of the next stage in your research.
I have to start on my answer here with the Lana chimpanzee project that I started in 1971.
Great, thanks.
In Atlanta, Georgia. Then I was with the Yerkes Primate Center, and the director was adamant that I do research on language acquisition with apes, and I didn't want to do it. I felt there was really nothing there in language, despite the fact I had learned what I had about the learning abilities of the great apes in contrast to monkeys. I didn't feel that they had any genuine capacity for language. That said, I yielded and I started, and I was shocked, delightfully shocked, to see how Lana chimpanzee learned the word lexigrams on the keyboard and learned how to organize them, and then on her own initiative transfer what she had learned to novel challenges, to new situations, to deal with problems that otherwise she could not solve. And I knew then that we had broached the language domain with the chimpanzee. And at that point then, Sue Savage, as she was then, joined the project and started in emphasizing more so socialization and chimpanzee-to-chimpanzee communication. And she demonstrated that the chimpanzees could learn to use their symbols with one another to get tools, to get foods, to get help, to go places and so on that otherwise they could not tell one another to do. It was the social coordination of learned symbols.
Briefly, so because many of the people haven't read the book and don't understand the precise nature of the research, talk about the lexigrams and how they were used and how that helped you understand that they were communicating between each other.
Yes. As I contemplated in 1970 how to go about language research with the apes, I knew that I did not want to use American Sign Language for the deaf, as others had used and used successfully, because you can't really capture objectively what happens other than by film. We didn't have even taped video at the time. It was all a very expensive process. So I, after a lot of thought, I finally thought, well, let's develop a keyboard. And then I started thinking in terms of a typewriter which had a lot of problems in that it was ridiculous to think of having an ape spell a word when they didn't even know what a word was. And then I thought, well, why don't we just have each word be a key, or to turn around for each key to be a word? Fine. But we would have to have a way of moving those keys around, lest the animals just learn where you punch to get a banana, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I have to learn something that would differentiate one key from another. And we came up with the idea of having a geometric pattern that Ernst von Wasserfeld named a lexigram subsequently, and that was a nice label for it. But the lexigrams are basically a variety of geometric symbols. They could each stand for an action like eating or giving or going, or a food or a drink or a place or a state, for example, music or slides or what have you. And we developed a beautiful keyboard on the basis that, yes, I would say it was anthropomorphically designed. I asked myself, if I were an ape in this situation, what would I like to see on the lexigram keyboard? So we designed it accordingly, and Lana agreed once she was in there, yeah, this is a cool thing, and learned very rapidly from it.
Why don't you briefly also explain actually the layout so that people can see this, because that'll help them understand
okay.
how you're able to observe.
Yes, well, the layout was that the initial keyboard was a 5x5 matrix of keys, 5 columns and 5 rows, and each key had a different lexigram on it, and each key was backlighted so as to be attractive, and each key, when pushed, became even brighter so that one could look to keep track of what it was that they had punched on the keyboard. And then in addition, in a row of little projectors overhead, a facsimile of each lexigram, as it was depressed in turn, came up and was left there until such time as the sentence effort was ended by the pressing of a period key. So it's like if you would, looking at an elevator control panel, and you know you want to go to floors 9, 7, 18, and so on. And they are punched. You know where the elevator is going to go to. But in addition now, we had not numbers. We had distinctive geometric forms, and we had the forms color-coded. That is, all foods were red, for example. All people and animals' names were violet, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And the computer, a PDP-8, which had less memory than our wristwatches, was programmed so as to monitor the sequence with which those lexigrams were selected. For example, if Lan wanted a banana, she would have to type into the computer, through use of her word lexigram keyboard, "Please, machine, give piece of banana." Or if she wanted music, she would have to type out, "Please, machine, make music. Please, machine, make window open. Please, machine, make slide. Please, Tim, move into room." Tim was her technician trainer, if you would. And so she learned a lot of different strings, sentence strings like that, that had to be organized in a specific way, else the computer would not acknowledge it as a valid request or statement.
And just as a brief, this was learned through the process of rewarding with favorite treats and different things.
That's snacks. Right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And she learned 6 different colors and the names of 6 different objects like bowl, ball, cup, and so on. And then we tested her, for example, can you, with 2 objects present, let's say a shoe and a bowl, with the shoe being purple and the bowl being orange, we ask her, what's the name of this that is orange? And she would have to select the object which is orange, namely the bowl in her attentional field, and then say, bowl name of this that's orange. Now, that's getting pretty swift, isn't it?
Now, would you actually, yes, it is. Would you ask them verbally those questions?
No. She would be asked through Tim using his own Mexagram keyboard.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great.
And she would read his request through another row of projectors above the one that produced her own Mexagrams.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like Tim sending a visual note to her, what's the name of this that's orange? And then she would read that and then respond, shoe name of this or bowl name of this that's orange.
Mm-hmm. Now, we were heading in the direction of your kind of some of your initial aha moments where you began to go, my gosh, they are actually communicating. Let's explore some of that.
The first day of excitement was when Tim was standing outside of Lana's plexiglass chamber, about an 8 by 8 foot chamber, and he was drinking a Coca-Cola, and she knew the name of Coke, and she liked Coca-Cola, and she went to the keyboard and made this statement, question, Lana drink this out of room. Well, Tim was staggered, and he said yes and opened the door for her, and she came out, and he gave her a bit of his Coke. And then he put her back in, and this was repeated 2 or 3 times. And in excitement, he called me and told me about it, and I said, no, Tim, that's wonderful, but we know that Lana knows what Coca-Cola is. So next time you do this, ask her what, quote, this, quote, is. And so he bought another Coke, stood outside of her room, and she again said, question, Lana drank this out of room. And Tim, through use of his keyboard, asked her, drink what out of room? And finally, after just 2 or 3 minor efforts, Lana said, Lana drink Coke out of room.
Hmm.
Now that was remarkable, and we were pleased that there was apparently effective two-way communication through use of her Lexigram keyboard. And there were a number of others. For example, infrequently, but nonetheless now and then, her vending machine for a given food would stick. And on a given day, for example, Lana was asking the machine, please, machine, give a piece of bread, over and over and over, and each time the machine would give her a good bite of bread. But then one day she asked, please, Beverly, move behind room. And Beverly moved behind the room, which people were instructed to do for other purposes. And then Lana again asked, please, machine, give piece of bread, please, machine, give piece of bread. And she pointed to the machine, which she could see through the plastic, and thereby directed Beverly's attention to it, and it wasn't working.
Hmm.
So Beverly rectified the problem, and then Lana got her bread over and over again.
Well, there was a wonderful example of where some food was hidden outside, and using a lexicon and behaviors, one of your subjects was able to take one of the researchers and direct him to that to discover this object that was kind of stuck in the ground or hidden under the grasses.
Oh, yes.
Which I thought was that to me was a real
yes.
indicator of very complex things.
Yes, yes. You're referring to the work with Pansy, chimpanzee.
Yes, uh-huh.
Pansy was co-reared with Panbenicia, a bonobo, to see whether the spontaneous comprehension of human speech by Kanzi was a function of his being a bonobo or whether it was a function of the kind of rearing that he had. So Sue and I ran a study along with others with Pansy and Panbenicia, rearing them from very shortly after birth. And to our surprise, Pansy, the common chimpanzee, came to understand human speech as did the bonobo Panbenicia. In other words, comprehension of human speech can occur spontaneously as it does in a human child, that is, without formal training. that's an important discovery, an important breakthrough. They learn to comprehend not just words as commands at all, but really in terms of their specific meanings, and their specific meanings as used in combinations, as in requests. Well, Pansy, with this rich background, was faced with a new challenge with another investigator, Charles Menzel. And he took a piece of food, a kind that she really liked, a favorite fruit, took it around outside the limits of her outdoor caging, and hid it in the forest floor, and then just left. And Pansy knew that the food was there, but didn't do anything about it immediately. But about 10 minutes later, he recruited Shelley Williams, who didn't know that the food had been hidden, to attend to what she, Pansy, was saying. And Pansy went through a number of efforts to tell her that there was something hidden outdoors. Shelley surmised that by her pointing and by her covering her eyes with her hands, indicating something was hidden. Hmm. And then she touched the key for the name of the food that was outside, and somehow conveyed to Shelley that it was hiding under sticks, because she too used the lexicon for sticks on the keyboard. And then as Shelley said to her, "Oh, there's something outdoors that's hidden, and you want me to go out and get it for you," words to that effect. And Pansy got all excited and yes, then gestured to her to go around the outside of the building as she raced up into the tunnel to go outdoors herself. Once outside, then Pansy very accurately pointed to the spot where she had seen this food, a kiwi, hidden. And the closer that Shelley got to it, the more excited Pansy got, until she was right really by the spot, and then Pansy cooled down and just looked. So she got the kiwi and then brought it around back into the building and gave it to Pansy. So this was a remarkable extension of Pansy's communication abilities from things that she had learned by her social rearing with Sue and her associates, and in Measure by Me, that she transferred them to a totally new situation years later in a different situation. Hmm. Now that's intelligent and it is specific.
Yes. There's another example, by the way.
There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of of her instances in which she has done this kind of thing in systematic studies being conducted by Charles Menzel.
Well, carry on. I'd like to know I'm trying to give some examples that I found astonishing. One that I found very entertaining, but also very enlightening.
Yes.
And I don't recall which animal. You'll be able to help me out with this. But this is a similar type of thing where somehow in the process of trying to help keep the cages clean, they trained the animals to urinate in some sort of little container. And so, and they were rewarded with M&Ms.
Yeah. But going back to Lana chimpanzee now again in the early 70s,
yeah.
But that was very, very interesting. In her chamber, Lana had a cage that she could go into, a small metal cage that was perched up off of the ground, off of the bottom of the chamber, which also was plexiglass. And she was being taught by Tim Gill to pee in the pan underneath the grill of that cage. And he was giving her an M&M candy, which she dearly loved, every time she would give a contribution of urine to that pan. And she got the idea real quickly, you know, pee a little bit, get an M&M, pee a little bit, get an M&M. Well, by straightforward conditioning theory or perspective, it should be that she would urinate with more and more vigor for longer and longer periods of time. Not Lana. What she learned was, you pee just a little bit and get an M&M. Pee just a little bit and get an M&M. And get more M&Ms that way. Well, that's interesting in its own right. But then eventually, even with the best of bladder control, she would run out of urine. And when she did run out of urine the first time, still in this training situation, what did she do? she turned around and spat into the pan. She had learned more than just to urinate in the pan. What she learned was the basic principle. Well, maybe it's getting liquid in the pan mm-hmm. that is really the task.
That's very complex.
Very complex. Mm-hmm. And even with rhesus macaques, we have observed that. If I may let me...
Sure, go ahead.
A rhesus macaque is, apart from humans, of the genus that is macaque, the most successful non-human primate form in the world in terms of reproduction and distribution. They are relatively large-bodied and relatively large-brained, but not to the degree that the great apes are. And we had the challenge of teaching a macaque monkey to use its foot to control an interactive task on a computer's monitor.
Right. In other words, I saw the picture of this, so to help my listeners, the animal would have to actually hang onto a ring, and then in order to move a joystick, which also was a very amazing thing that I didn't know that they could do, to use a joystick to manipulate on a computer screen an image to get the reward, he had to use his feet. So he was using
We had learned that every rhesus monkey we worked with could learn to use a joystick to do these complex tasks of a big variety that included all kinds of complex demands like predicting things and remembering things and being specific in the movements. They are great users of joysticks. And it was Sue in working with apes that first demonstrated this. They learned observationally from her, but interestingly, no rhesus monkey has learned observationally how to use the joystick. They've always had to be conditioned through use of specific training procedures. Now, the rhesus had to hang onto these rings in order to turn on the system. And with the rings being overhead, then they had only their foot to activate the joystick. They had not had any prior training with the joystick, ever. But they discovered in a situation that with their foot, there was movement of the joystick and a movement of the cursor on the screen, just as we use on our desktop computers. And that the task was to move that cursor, this was after substantial training, to make contact with a moving target on the screen.
Hmm.
And the target moved erratically. So it took challenge. It was a challenging thing for the rhesus to control the movement of that cursor to hit that target. But they eventually did it. After this rhesus macaque monkey got as good with its foot as what other monkeys had become with their hands in this task, then this monkey was given a special test, a special day of opportunity. The rings were no longer there. The rhesus no longer had to pull down on these rings in order to make the system work. And what would it do? Now, from a reinforcement learning perspective, the rhesus monkey should have used its foot. That's what it had been, quotes, reinforced, quotes, for doing all the way along the line over the course of weeks and months. But it did not. It used its hand right off. And that was a surprise. No one had predicted that. But more important than that, no one had predicted that the rhesus would be better in using its hand with the joystick than it had ever been with its foot. In other words, the rhesus monkey had learned not the conditioned response of using its foot and the joystick. It had learned about the task. It had learned that the task was to move the cursor to impact with the moving target, and it somehow knew that it could do that better right off with its hand than what it had ever done with its foot. That is the transferring of learning, not by specific muscular response, not by specific behavior patterning, but by principle, by some kind of a rational behavioral process.
It would also, from my perspective, indicate a very real and powerful body awareness, an awareness of it, of who it was as a being.
I think so.
Yeah. I mean, to make that transference within its own body, to realize that, well, I can do this, but I could probably do this better with my hand.
Yeah.
How,
it's intelligent.
That is intelligence. That's correct. That is suggesting a pretty complex, well, really very effective use of intelligence. I often think about people who are trying to open a box, for example. You watch people are trying to open something, and I'm always intrigued by the fact that they'll take it and they'll go through a whole series of behaviors. They'll pry and do this and that and whatever else. Maybe they can't figure it out. And after a while, they start to perhaps bang it on things. We just go through these processes of trying to figure out what will work, and finally we find a way. And this animal was able to do a very similar type of experience.
That's right. Animals can think. They can come to learn how to think. They don't just think, period. Their thinking ability rests upon an enriched, appropriate kind of early rearing experience. And social rearing is the best context within which to do that, unless one is talking about learning about human talents and skills, like human speech, comprehension of human speech. Clearly, then they have to be reared around humans. But no ape will learn to comprehend human speech unless they are reared around human speech and hear human speech in a way that is informative to them by way of understanding what's happening, what has happened, what it is that they're interested in, and so on.
Dr. Rimbaugh, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about Kanza, because they're talking about transference and language and intelligence. That's a story that really began to develop a huge aha moment in your research. So when we return, we'll explore some of the stories of Kanza and beyond.